Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, the White House tells the world they're serious about climate change. At a global summit last week, President Biden made a clear break from his predecessor, announcing ambitious new greenhouse gas emission standards for the U.S. In setting a high target, Biden is hoping to push this country and others to make the necessary changes to address the urgency of a warming planet. But reaching Biden's goal to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 50 to 52% by the year 2030 would require a remaking of this country's economy, not to mention congressional approval. To talk more about details of Biden's proposal, I spoke with Umair Irfan, climate change and energy reporter for Vox. We spoke Tuesday morning. Umair, last week the White House held its first global climate summit. Talk about why the president called this and who participated.
Well, President Biden made climate change a central piece of his campaign, and this was a key way to deliver on that, not just domestically, but internationally. You may recall the U.S. left the Paris Climate Agreement because President Trump wanted to pull the U.S. out of the accord. And shortly after taking office, Biden brought the U.S. back in. But it's not so simple. The U.S. also has to have some deliverables. The U.S. has to make good on its previous promises to the rest of the world, but also come up with new ambitions to deal with climate change. So this summit was sort of a trust-building exercise where Biden convened 40 world leaders, some of the largest emitters in the world, including China, and members of the European Union as well, and basically wanted to show them that the U.S. is back in the game and is taking this very seriously.
Was it a fairly agreeable meeting?
It was. I think the attitudes coming in and going out were both very positive from the reception from the folks that were observing it. I mean, the big highlight here was that the U.S. did agree to increase its ambitions on climate change, which was something that was not a foregone conclusion, but was very reassuring to other countries in the world who are taking climate change pretty seriously. The top line outcome of this meeting was where the U.S. announced that it was planning to cut its greenhouse gas emissions by 50 to 52% by 2030 relative to the levels in 2005.
How significant is that commitment?
Well, it's both very significant, but also not that significant at the same time. Certainly, this is the most ambitious the United States has ever been on climate change. But it's important to keep a couple things in mind. The first is the baseline. The U.S. commitment is relative to 2005, and that's when greenhouse gas emissions were actually higher than they are now. So the 52 to 52% cut by 2030, that's roughly a 42% just relative to today's levels. The other thing to remember is this is not the first time the U.S. has issued a climate change commitment either. Back when the Paris Climate Accord was convened in 2015, the U.S. committed to cutting its greenhouse gases about 28% by 2025. So if the U.S. were to hit its previous goal, it would actually reach 38% by 2030. So the new target is actually a 12 to 14% increase from the previous target. All that said, the U.S. is not on track for even meeting its lower ambition under that previous goal. So this new target is certainly more ambitious, but the actions have yet to meet that goal.
The question then of putting pressure on the rest of the world via these stated goals, does that look somehow false, or does it actually put pressure out there?
Well, it certainly puts pressure out there for other countries to be more ambitious. You know, the United States is the world's second largest greenhouse gas emitter, but it's only accountable for about 15% of current levels of greenhouse gases, which means in order to fight climate change, everybody has to chip in. But the United States, because it has such an outsized role, a lot of countries do follow the United States' lead. So we saw under the past 4 years under Trump, as the U.S. was pulling out of the accord, a lot of other countries were being a little bit more lackadaisical about their ambitions. Some of them were walking back some of their previous goals or declining to put in new, more ambitious targets. So the U.S. saying that it wants to actually do more signals to the rest of the world that they should probably start doing more as well. Otherwise, you know, it would be harder to play ball. For instance, you know, the United States could potentially impose restrictions on countries when it comes to trade on countries that aren't really taking climate change very seriously. And we've actually seen the European Union already saying they want to do that. They're talking about imposing a border adjustment carbon tax on countries that aren't doing enough to fight climate change. So it effectively adds tariffs to goods from countries that aren't doing enough. But again, you know, this has to actually materialize in action, and that's a little bit harder. And, you know, these targets are painted 10 years into the future, but we need action starting today. And that's much harder to see right now, especially since most of the world is still coping with the COVID-19 pandemic and is really worried about their own economies.
And what about the Congress? To what extent does the president need their approval to move forward with these cuts?
Well, President Biden has tried to do as much as he can from the White House. You know, shortly after taking office, he signed a whole bunch of executive orders, doing things like revoking the permit for the Keystone XL pipeline, expanding federal land protections, barring new fossil fuel development on federal lands. But he also did things like making climate change an important factor in all federal planning, basically taking climate change out of the silo of the environment and telling the whole government that you have to think about climate change in everything that you do, from the vehicles you purchase to the buildings you upgrade to the people that are going to be affected by actions like climate change, people who are going to be affected by sea level rise. Now, there's only so much you can do from the White House. And yeah, certainly Biden will need Congress to get on board, especially if he wants to spend money, particularly this $2 trillion infrastructure plan that he's been talking about. A key component of that is going to be addressing climate change. And certainly he'll need Congress to be on board with that.
So it sounds as though this proposal by Biden is going to affect the entire U.S. economy.
That's right. You know, he does want an economy-wide focus, and he has set an economy-wide goal. You know, looking out to 2050, he wants the entire U.S. economy to be carbon neutral, basically to have no net impact on the climate by the middle of the century. And that requires every part to contribute. So it's agriculture, it's business, it's housing, it's going to be how we produce electricity and energy. It's also going to be how we produce food. And also like where we locate people over a period of time. As climate risks go up, certain parts of the country will become less likely to be inhabitable. Like, are we going to continue rebuilding on coastlines after repeated flooding, or are we going to help people relocate? Those are some of the difficult questions that he wants to address. And certainly he wants to get that ball rolling now, in part with this infrastructure plan. And now there are some Republicans that are willing to engage on it. They did recently put out a sort of a counter proposal. It's much smaller, but it shows that there is some common ground when you look at things like roads and bridges, where there could be some overlap to at least do things in a more conscientious way for the environment.
He did make a pledge that 100% of America's energy would be carbon free by 2035. How does he accomplish that? Is that a realistic pledge?
I mean, it's hard to see that in the current moment, because the U.S. greenhouse gas emissions have been holding steady and are probably going to rise again this year. So it would have to be a pretty abrupt turn. And, you know, 2035 is less than 15 years away. So that's a pretty drastic shift. On the other hand, there's a lot of momentum already baked into the U.S. economy. We've seen, you know, coal declining quite drastically nonstop over the past, you know, century, essentially. And also other fossil fuels like natural gas are increasingly struggling because they're having a hard time keeping up. And as we impose more restrictions on carbon dioxide, fossil fuels will become less attractive. And at the same time, more renewable energy and cleaner energy sources are becoming so much cheaper, faster than anybody had ever imagined. It's very likely that solar will be the dominant source of new energy going forward. And things like wind and offshore wind in particular are going to become a larger and larger share of the U.S. energy infrastructure piece. The open question is whether nuclear will continue to remain an important player. Nuclear energy provides the most carbon-free electricity in the United States, and most of the U.S. power fleet is decades old. So it may require more construction and more development in the coming years in order to shore that up. But it's clear that there are some trends that are pushing the U.S. towards a cleaner economy. Whether we can get to zero, that will probably require a lot more concerted and deliberate action. So things like imposing a carbon tax or imposing a cap and trade scheme to help mitigate greenhouse gas emissions overall.
What about electric vehicles? What's the target there?
Well, Joe Biden's a big fan of electric vehicles, and certainly he wants to promote them a lot. And the U.S. auto industry seems to be thinking that electric vehicles are the future. You know, General Motors recently said that they anticipate that all of their cars are going to be electric. Volkswagen said that they expect all of about half of their new car sales to be electric by 2030. And, you know, there are every major U.S. automaker is developing more EVs. Now, in terms of what Biden practically wants to do through this infrastructure plan, he's talking about building 500,000 new electric vehicle chargers across the country. So building up the infrastructure, you know, there's sort of this chicken and egg problem with EVs. You know, people don't buy them because they don't have enough places to charge up. So he's trying to solve that part of the equation. Now, the other question is, you know, are Americans willing to trade in their older, dirtier cars for these cleaner cars? That's going to take some more incentives, something like another cash for clunkers type program where we give people an incentive to upgrade some of their oldest and dirtiest cars for some of these cleaner cars. But the other factor is also going to be making these cheaper. You know, if the car is already cheaper and it's cleaner, then the argument really makes itself. And so one way they're going to do that is through tax credits and tax incentives. There's also going to be grants. And the other big thing is the he wants to use the purchasing power of the federal government. You know, the U.S. federal government has its own massive vehicle fleet, about 650,000 cars. And so he wants those cars to be all electric. And so by basically telling car makers in the U.S., we're going to be a guaranteed customer for you, and we're going to buy hundreds of thousands of these cars, that gives them an incentive to start development now. And that also helps them reach economies of scale. So once you're buying in bulk, the overall cost will decline, and you know, consumers, ordinary car buyers, will be able to reap those benefits.
I was at the Safeway nearby the other day, and along one whole wall were electric chargers, and every one was filled by a Tesla. Has the time for Tesla and its all electric vehicle really come?
I think it's a little bit too soon for that right now. You know, electric vehicles are still about 2% of new car sales in the U.S.
2%.
Yeah. And so you need to drastically increase their market share. And I don't think Tesla actually has the production capacity to meet that. Now, certainly the other major automakers are promoting their own electric vehicles as well, but you need people to actually start buying them. And right now, one, people are a little bit reluctant to spend money because of the pandemic, because a lot of pocketbooks are really tight right now. And the other factor is that, you know, buying cars in general is expensive. And so when we're talking about electrification, we shouldn't just be talking about cars. It's going to be things like electric buses, you know, public transit, you know, decarbonizing those. A big part of Biden's plan is, you know, building electric school buses. So children are less exposed to things like diesel school buses and not have to deal with that kind of pollution. But also things like electric bikes. You know, the vast majority of car trips in the U.S. are less than 10 miles. And it doesn't always make sense to take a 2,000 to 3,000 pound car to the grocery store with you. So if you offer people alternatives, things like even scooters, electric bicycles, and other forms of transit that don't produce any emissions, you know, you could help get rid of all these vehicle trips to begin with. And that will also have huge outsized benefits for the environment.
Speaking of the COVID virus, I wonder to what extent that has reduced the amount of emissions we see in this country over the past year.
Yeah, we did see a big drop in emissions in the United States and around the world. You know, we saw some of the largest declines in coal use since World War II. So this was a huge, unprecedented economic disaster. And those that impact definitely did bear out in terms of the overall output of greenhouse gases annually. All that said, greenhouse gas emissions weren't zero, so the net amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere is still increasing, and we recently crossed a new record of atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide, topping 420 parts per million for the first time in human history. So even with a lower output of greenhouse gas emissions, it's still causing an increase in warming.
More of my conversation with Umer Irfan when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture,
and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Umer Irfan. He's climate change and energy reporter for Vox. Tell me about the use of coal in this country. How many states continue to rely on coal for their economic productivity?
Yeah, the story of coal has been just one of a massive decline. You know, we had about 800,000 coal workers in the United States back in the 1920s, and now we're basically in the tens of thousands total across the whole country. And it's still declining. You know, coal companies have been going bankrupt left and right. Coal plants are shutting down. And this is not due to regulations, but due to competition from other energy sources, namely natural gas, which produces about half of the CO2 of coal and costs less, but it still produces CO2, so it's not the most ideal solution. But in the U.S., I mean, we're already seeing a decline. And so there's going to be have to be some way to deal with these workers. And certainly the Biden administration has talked about shoring up pension plans for coal workers, also investing in job retraining. But eventually coal is going to decline on its own. Now, whether we should accelerate that decline in order to help meet the climate goals, I mean, that remains to be seen. It's also very politically contentious because you have places like West Virginia that still have a significant coal sector, or places like Wyoming that do a fair amount of coal extraction. And, you know, Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia is now the big swing vote in the Senate for a lot of what Democrats want to accomplish. And so he's going to be a gatekeeper to a lot of this. But all that said, again, you know, coal is on its way out. And the U.S. needs to start grappling for that. Internationally, coal is sort of a mixed picture, too. There are some countries where coal is also declining because of competition from other fuels, but there are a lot of growing economies. You know, we still have about 900 million people around the world that don't have electricity. And so there's still a number of people that need to desperately get their way out of poverty, and oftentimes fossil fuels are the cheapest way to do that. That said, you know, some of these countries that finance coal plants, that, you know, help developing countries build these coal plants, are saying that they don't want to do that anymore, that essentially that we're not going to continue financing these coal plants, even though that they argue that these plants are some of the most efficient, top-of-the-line plants. They want to end fossil use completely. Now, in order to do that, they need these developing countries need an alternative, and that framework hasn't quite materialized. There are some programs to help, you know, poorer countries build out their electricity infrastructure using renewables and other lower carbon sources, but they're vastly underinvested for the scale of what's actually needed, particularly in places like sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia. And so that's where things can go either way. We could see a massive growth in coal, or we could actually see some of these countries leapfrog coal technology towards more cleaner technology.
What about China? Where does China stand on coal?
China's coal use has been relatively flat. You know, it tends to go up and down based on how its economy is doing. And they were also doing a lot of coal financing in other countries as well. But they've set their own climate targets. You know, they said that they want to reach a peak in their greenhouse gas emissions sometime before 2030 and then start to decline. And they're estimating that they will be carbon neutral by about 2060, which is a little bit later than what other countries are hoping to hit as far as the target goes. But China is already, you know, seeing that the effects of coal. You know, we've seen massive amounts of air pollution over Chinese cities. And it's also become a political issue. Everybody has to breathe the air, and people don't like dealing with the effects of this pollution. And so they've taken some steps to mitigate that air pollution, including reducing the use of coal. But they still need a fair amount because they still are planning to grow their economy more. Now, they've also invested a great deal in renewables and also in nuclear technology as well. And the question for them is, you know, for them, it's a throw everything at the wall and see what sticks. You know, they need all the energy that they can get. But as they continue to grow and as their economy develops, it seems there's more pressure on them to be a little bit more choosy about the kind of energy sources they use. And since China is the world's largest greenhouse gas emitter, everything it does will have, you know, global consequences. And so over time, there will be a lot more political pressure on them to use less coal.
And what about India?
Right. You know, India was one of the other countries that didn't come into the table at Biden's summit with new ambitions. And yeah, they're the number three emitter. And so the top three countries in the world are China, the United States, and India. So yeah, they're already, you know, dealing with some of the similar problems as China, but they're also trying to lift people out of poverty, and they do have a ton of coal at their disposal that they're importing and developing locally. And they've been a little bit more reluctant, you know, to embrace some of these clean energy targets, because they say that their priority is to improve their economy and to raise their standard of living. And that's going to be a tougher sell for countries like India, which has less wealth to go around among more people. And that's where international pressure, but also international assistance, can play a big role. Things like financing clean energy technologies in India, and also things like sharing technology, you know, lift patent restrictions on certain kinds of things like batteries and solar panels, and allowing them to develop them locally so they can also boost their economy domestically, as well as deploying more clean energy. But it's a hard sell. You know, India has been one of the larger holdout countries in terms of ramping up what they want to do about climate change.
Isn't the air quality in India one of the worst?
Yeah, the cities with some of the worst air quality in the world are in India. You know, you see in the capital region around Delhi, around November, basically, like, they has literally off the charts levels of air pollution. And so part of that is due to energy use, but part of that is also due to other sources like agriculture, like burning crop stubble after the season. And so there's a lot of different sources of pollution, and it is becoming a political issue, but energy is not the only source there, which is why it's harder for them to build up the pressure to clean up their energy sector, because there's multiple major sources contributing to pollution, not just the electricity production.
Back to this country, Umair, what's been the reaction from the U.S. business community?
It's been surprisingly upbeat. You know, after President Trump announced that the U.S. was going to withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement, you actually saw a number of U.S. companies saying that they wanted to stay in and play ball. And a large reason is that because many U.S. companies do business in other countries. And so while the U.S. maybe was relaxing some of its greenhouse gas restrictions, other countries were still moving ahead. And they realized that, you know, in order to compete internationally, they still have to do more. And so you had these companies, these major companies like, you know, automakers, but also like financial companies and tech companies, all saying that they set their own targets. Like, you know, Microsoft said about a year ago that they essentially want to zero out all of their emissions that they have ever produced. So not just what they're producing now, but actually going back in time and pulling out those CO2 emissions from the air. And similarly, companies like Google and all these other tech giants are talking about sourcing all of their electricity eventually from 100% clean energy. So there's a fair amount of momentum on the business sector. Certainly there are some companies, like some heavy industry companies, that are worried about higher electricity prices. But for the most part, they do realize that they're seeing sort of the handwriting on the wall, saying that eventually we're going to be in a world where carbon dioxide is going to be restricted, and we need to start preparing for that now. And after, you know, the summit, and after Biden jumped in, you know, plenty of U.S. companies applauded that decision as well. So it doesn't seem like the U.S. business community in general is holding out, though there are a few individual cases of some companies that are, you know, opposed to this.
On the other hand, there are some of those on the far left who think that Biden's plan doesn't go far enough.
Right. I mean, I pointed out earlier that the United States contributes about 15% of global greenhouse gas emissions. But historically, the U.S. is the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions. Basically, since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, the majority of the carbon dioxide that's in the atmosphere came from the United States. And the United States became an immensely wealthy country by burning those fossil fuels. The U.S. built up a vast volume of riches across its whole economy. And so a lot of activists say that because the U.S. got wealthy and contributed the most to climate change as we experience it now, the U.S. has a much larger role. It shouldn't simply be trying to reduce its emissions relative to what it's contributing now, but it should also reduce its emissions to account for its historical impact on climate change. The people that are going to be suffering the worst consequences of climate change are the ones that contributed least to the problem. So in order to address that inequity, countries that are already wealthy, that have already burned the most fossil fuels, they should face a greater responsibility to act on that. And so some have suggested that the U.S. should actually be aiming for a 70% cut below 2005 levels by 2030, something a little bit more ambitious than what we've done now.
So just how powerful are these climate activists right now?
I mean, it's hard to quantify, but it's also hard to imagine that we would be here now without this concerted push of climate activists over the past 5 to 10 years. That's particularly picked up in the last couple of years, you know, in advance of the U.S. election. I mean, you may recall right before, during the Democratic primary, you know, we had every Democratic contender come forward with a climate change plan in a televised primetime, back-to-back town hall where they all pitched all their goals for dealing with climate change. Like, it's hard to imagine a single issue receiving that kind of attention on any topic in years past, and now that was the central focus. And even Joe Biden, who was, you know, considered to be one of the more middle-of-the-road candidates, he put forward the most ambitious plan that the U.S. has ever seen, even though it wasn't the most ambitious among the candidates in the field. So certainly the needle has moved, the discussion has changed, and now the expectation is that climate change is going to be a central issue. The question is exactly what the U.S. will do in terms of policy and meeting those goals.
And how much of a fight do you expect in Congress?
I mean, everything is going to be a fight in Congress, especially with one that's so narrowly divided as it is today. And, you know, I mentioned, you know, Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia, who's a Democrat, is also from a big coal state. And he is going to be one of the key swing votes in terms of actually being able to implement this agenda, particularly in terms of getting money to actually spend and make these investments. So I don't think this is going to be an easy process. There is some opportunity for common ground, particularly things like building up infrastructure. But for things like accelerating the decline of fossil fuels or, you know, putting more restrictions on carbon dioxide emissions, those are going to be a bigger challenge. And those are certainly things that are going to be needed in order to meet these climate goals, as ambitious as they are. So I think the next few years are just going to be critical to what the U.S. can accomplish over the next 10.
So there's another climate meeting this fall. What do you expect to happen then?
So this is the meeting of the parties to the Paris Climate Agreement, and that's going to be in Glasgow, Scotland. And typically what countries do is they regroup and they talk about what their ambitions are and also go over the rules of how they're going to actually meet their targets. For this meeting, since it was supposed to be roughly the 5-year anniversary of the Paris Agreement, this is where every country was supposed to come back to the table with more ambitions. And to date, we have about more than 100 countries out of the 190 or so countries that have already put out more aggressive goals. There are about close to 60 countries that have set targets for zeroing out their emissions completely. So for them, there's not much more left for them to do. But the question is going to be getting some of the holdouts, some of the other large emitters that aren't necessarily the largest emitters, to actually commit to doing more. So countries like India, but also countries like, you know, Russia and Saudi Arabia, these countries that do depend on exporting fossil fuels, whether they're willing to make any commitments to actually reducing their impact on the climate. They've been holdouts for a long time, and there's going to be more pressure on them to act now, but they haven't really moved very much before, and it's going to be hard to do that this time. And so there's going to be a lot of attention on the U.S. for being one of the largest, one of the largest targets. And a lot of people are going to be asking the Americans, you know, okay, you set your target for 2030. What are you going to be doing this year? You know, you have to get on that path right now. Well, what's the next step? And that's, that's going to remains to be seen whether the U.S. actually has something tangible to show the rest of the world that it's doing.
Any predictions as to whether that meeting will be in person or via Zoom?
It really depends on how the rest of the pandemic goes. You know, this meeting was originally scheduled to happen last year, and it was postponed because of the COVID-19 pandemic. So it looks like there are opening up hotels there, and the venue has been booked. And so I think people are expecting to have an in-person meeting. But we've seen that, you know, right now the pandemic is in its worst stage yet. If you look at the international picture, you know, India just set record highs in terms of new cases. And it's very likely that, you know, we'll see these peaks move to different parts of the world. We might see other countries that see surges in the coming months. So I don't think we'll be out of the woods yet when it comes to this pandemic. And there may be a lot of countries where people cannot send delegates because they're still dealing with their own crisis. Or it may just be that they may go remote again out of solidarity with other countries that are still dealing with the pandemic.
And talk about the money they would save doing it that way.
Certainly, there's a big push for that. You know, it seems a little hypocritical for gathering all these world leaders for an in-person meeting when we've learned over the past year that you can do a lot of this remotely. On the other hand, I mean, at these big international meetings, there's a lot of stuff that goes on the sidelines. And, you know, you miss that kind of opportunity to sort of have a side deal or have, like, you know, a heart-to-heart with somebody, with another negotiator, and find out what they're really thinking and you know, read between the lines. And so there is something to be said for that. But granted, I mean, that is something that you have to weigh and consider. Is it worth the carbon footprint of having people from 195 countries meeting all in one place? And certainly, there's immense pressure from activists not to do that. And so it remains to be seen whether they will yield to that pressure or not.
Thank you so much for being with us.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you.
That was Umer Irfan. He's climate change and energy reporter for Vox. He's also a contributor to Science Friday. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman, Sandra Baker, and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all. Stay well. Be safe. I'm Diane Rehm.